This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hi, hello everybody. This is Basma Farhat, and this week we're here with the People Speak along with my co-host John O'Neill.
Hello.
How are you, John?
Good, good.
Good to have you aboard again. We're going to do it. We've got a great guest tonight, and we've got a real surprise for everybody in our audience. We'd like to let you know that we are currently working with Don Newsom in a new program called BBS Radio. This network is just an incredible new opportunity for our show, and we're really glad to be on board with BBS Radio as well as Pal Talk. Our guest tonight is Medea Benjamin. She's the co-founder of Code Pink, and Medea's had a very interesting few months, and I'm really looking forward to tapping into what's been going on in her life. She's an environmentalist, an activist for social change. She works within the San Francisco-based organization GlobalExchange.org. Her organization, Code Pink, has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. We missed the opportunity to speak to her last month because she, Medea, was detained in
just
jail.
Yeah.
Remember that?
We tried our darndest, but she was in a whirlwind that day for sure. Absolutely.
Although she was wonderful, she did offer us a great opportunity to speak with Anne Wright and Raj Rai. And so what we're going to be doing now is introducing Medea Benjamin.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Sorry I couldn't make it the last time.
We're really thrilled to have you with us. This is my co-host, John Neal from the Kentucky area, and I'm calling from the Michigan area. We are on a new broadcasting network, and we're really thrilled to have you with us, Medea. The last time, I don't know if you heard me, but we weren't able to connect to you. That was the infamous day at the Iraqi speech where you got arrested.
Oh, when the prime minister was in town. I figured if he wasn't going to speak for the Iraqi people, maybe someone else should.
Well, we're glad you did, that's for sure. You want to talk to us about that? What happened that day?
Well, when we heard that he was coming to Washington, we were trying so hard to get a meeting with him and thought we were successful because the Iraqi ambassador said, okay, here's the time, the place. It was Cindy Sheehan and myself, and we went to the right place at the right time, and not only did they not show up, they had the police out there threatening to arrest us. So we figured we tried the diplomatic route. We tried the let's sit down and talk, and instead we had to go the next day when he was speaking before the joint House and the Senate. And as I was listening to him, he sounded like it was Karl Rove that wrote his speech. He was saying, you know, Iraq is with you in the war on terrorism, and taking this whole myth that Iraq had something to do with 9/11 and making like it was really true. And then perpetuating this whole idea that if the U.S. troops left, it would be worse for the Iraqi people, whereas the majority of Iraqis don't think that way. We've seen in poll after poll how they say that they want the U.S. troops to leave. So I got up at one point and said, Iraqis want the troops to leave, bring them home now, and kept shouting it until they took me out.
Until they certainly took you out. We saw that.
Physically, yes.
Oh,
lifted in the air.
How interesting. And did they actually arrest you that day, Medea?
Well, they did, and they have I have to go back for a court date in Washington next week. And they were saying to me, you know, this used to be a misdemeanor, but now we've made this a felony, and they're trying to scare me. I don't really know what. I know I'm charged with disruption of Congress, but have no idea if they're going to really try to pursue it or just give me a fine. But I'll know in the next couple of weeks.
Well, thank you very much, Patriots Act. What do you say, John?
Oh, it seems to be getting more stringent every day.
Well, that's right. You know,
it's so good to have people that have the wherewithal and the opportunity to actually move around this planet and speak out against some of the injustices that occur here. And tomorrow, I think, is going to be an important day for you, Medea, you and those that you work with. John Bolton, is that tomorrow? I think I saw it mentioned. He's not one of my favorite people, John Bolton.
No, and he's coming up for confirmation.
John Bolton call-in day tomorrow. That is tomorrow, correct?
That's right. We've tried to stop John Bolton from the very beginning, and we'll be trying again tomorrow. He's going to be coming up this week for confirmation in the Senate. And for your listeners who don't know, this guy is sort of the anti-diplomat. He's taken great pains during his career to escalate crises instead of trying to use conflict resolution skills. And we saw it just now in the case of Lebanon, where the world was crying out for a ceasefire, and John Bolton was saying, no, ceasefire, that's old thinking. I wanted to give the Israelis more time to kill more Lebanese people.
Well, of course, isn't that the process?
Well, yeah, it didn't go over too well, not only in Lebanon, where we were, but all over the Middle East, where he basically came out and said that the lives of the Lebanese can't be equated with the lives of the Israelis, and got
John
people in the Middle East
know?
So upset.
That is stunning, absolutely stunning. And, you know, Medea, this is something that I've often said. You know, I think that I have a great concern for the American listening and viewing audience in relationship to our media. One of the things that I've always been a believer in and understand is that nobody's really hiding the truth. We're just not hearing it.
That's right.
Do you
got it.
Agree with me on that?
Totally. I mean, if people wanted to hear what John Bolton has said, they could do a little Google of John Bolton Lebanon and find all these outrageous quotes. But it's not going to be in the mainstream media, and I doubt that most people know how the rest of the world views us and how when the world was saying we've got to stop the killing of Israelis and Lebanese, our government basically, by itself, with Israel, was saying, no, ceasefire isn't necessary.
Well, I think what Condoleezza Rice also affirmed that, and I don't know if this is just a comedy of errors or just a mimicking of each other's parodies and speeches, when she said that we want to wait for a ceasefire. And I thought to myself, well, when is it a good time to stop killing people?
Exactly, but it's no mistake. It was their policy. They thought if they gave the Israelis a couple of weeks, the Israelis would knock out Hezbollah, wouldn't be a threat anymore, and wanted to, quote, give it time.
Well, just,
of course,
just to update our audience on John Bolton, he's a recess appointment. It's due to expire, I think, January 2007. And he did not make it out as far as the vote went. Actually, I think Congress went into recess, and then President Bush appointed him as a recess appointment. And it's amazing to me. I can see why there would be a hang up in the confirmation process for this particular individual, because someone that is actually sitting in a chair being asked questions about a future possible position in the United Nations, someone who said so many things so harshly about the whole idea of the United Nations. It's on video. I know you've seen it, where he's very vehement and he's very charged, very super energy charged with the whole idea that the United Nations could lose, I think, what did he say, 10 stories of their building and it wouldn't make any difference.
Right. Very diplomatic thing to say, huh?
Someone is actually being considered for an ambassadorship that talks about the whole the sacred body of the United Nations, the people that work for the United Nations, you know, they treat it more than just a job. And if you're applying for that particular position, the U.S. ambassador, you would expect the person to have skills that would allow them to actually talk in a civil, calm, intellectual fashion to solve problems. But he's a fireplug. And to have him snuck in under the wire as a recess appointment is very insulting to me. And then to have him actually have the opportunity to carry on with this process and be actually interviewed more for a permanent appointment is scary to me. Because
which Medea, brings me to the question, as an activist, as a proponent of free speech and condemning the actions that we are currently taking around the world, how are you and your group, organization,
Global Exchange and Code Pink
and Camp Democracy, what are you doing? What are the tools that you're offering to people in order to make and implement changes in these areas? How are you I think that there's a lack of training on the part of the people in this country and the lack of the ability to offer them tools. What kind of tools are you guys offering the people of the United States?
Well, it's a good question because we are offering a lot of tools, and I do agree with you that people don't have the right kind of training to do activism. You certainly don't go through your high school or college career and come out saying, aha, now I know how to influence you government policy. So we do a lot of trainings. We have, and when I say we, it's both as my hat with Global Exchange, a human rights group based in San Francisco, and Code Pink, a peace group. And we have people that sign up on our weekly email alerts, and on those alerts we give them ideas of what they can do to have an influence, like the alert this week will be about John Bolton, or we have conference calls where an expert will get on and train them about how to be a media spokesperson. We have retreats that we organize where people can come and get direct kind of training. And those trainings are everything from how to organize a house
and
party.
And are you doing this under a networking program with other peace movements, Medea?
Well, we're under the umbrella of United for Peace and Justice, which is a coalition of about 1,400 peace groups around the country.
Actually, I'm a member.
The what?
I am a member. So
oh,
I
you are a member. Very good. Group. Yes.
Wonderful. You know, and I think this is the key, Medea. And if I would ask of any of our peace groups, and that is to constant reinforcement that we are not powerless in this, although a lot of people are very disenfranchised with our votes because of the corruption that we believe that has manifested in our voting system. I think that a lot of people are still very concerned about, do they really have this kind of impact that they think they do? And I think it's valuable for you as peace activists and leaders in this area to continue to educate people and train them as to how they can make a difference.
Well, that's right. And we really do feel that our problem right now is not so much people being ill-informed, well, that is a problem, but it's more being disempowered. When you look at the majority of people now saying that the war in Iraq was a mistake and the troops should come home sooner rather than later, how do you translate that into real public pressure? And one of our campaigns is called Voters for Peace, to try to get literally millions of people before the 2008 elections to sign a pledge saying they will only vote for candidates who make a speedy withdrawal from Iraq and no future wars of aggression part of their policies. And any of your listeners who are interested can go to the CodePinkAlert.org website and sign that voter's pledge.
Medea, how realistic is that?
I think it's very realistic. We've already seen in the case of Connecticut how Joseph Lieberman was unable to win the Democratic Party nomination because of his pro-war view, and that sent a message to a lot of other candidates who are starting to come around. We see even a Republican, Christopher Shea, who just got back from another trip to Iraq, saying that now he thinks we need a fixed timetable for withdrawal. I think we'll see some changes in this November election, and then I think the eyes will be focused on the leadership in the White House and who can we get to replace George Bush, who will get us out of Iraq and stop us from Armageddon that looks like the way the Bush administration is going. They want to have a war in Iran, a war in Syria, possibly North Korea, and I don't think the American people want to live in a state of perpetual war.
Or a perpetual draft for 8 to 20 years.
Or perpetual fear.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, John and I were talking, and we'd like to hear a little bit about your recent visit to Jordan upon the was it actually breaking the fast that you guys were doing in the Jordanian region?
That's right. We went to Jordan to meet with Iraqi parliamentarians. We broke our fast at 30 days, and we sat down with them to talk about their efforts at reconciliation. You know, you hear George Bush saying that if we left Iraq, that that would just give a boost to the insurgents and plunge Iraq into a civil war. And yet we met with members of parliament from the Sunni and the Shia factions, who both said the same thing, that if there were a fixed timetable for withdrawal of U.S. troops, that would allow them to sit down at the negotiating table with other armed groups to say, okay, how are we going to both end the occupation of our country and the sectarian violence as well? So I think we came back with a greater commitment to support the Iraqi people's own efforts at reconciliation, with the understanding that that includes the withdrawal of all foreign forces from their country.
I see.
You can make a very short list of those who benefit from this current war of aggression against a military tactic that actually, the groundwork has been laid out for this to be a long-term global conflagration. The PNAC documents talk about multiple simultaneous theaters of war to propel their think tank clique into their next, I don't know what you could call it, where they want to go, but they are benefiting from this, and it's a fairly short list of those who benefit. It would be great if we could just vote out those who benefit, but the way the money exchanges hands in Washington, D.C., it's hard not to have the compromise that occurs when politicians are bought out with large sums of cash. I'm beginning to ramble on that. Maybe I should just hold off just for a second and think about that. It's 8:18 p.m. Eastern Time here in Kentucky. I think it's the same up there in Michigan. Where are you currently stationed, Medea?
I'm in San Francisco right now.
So she's 5:18 out there on the West Coast. This is the BBS Radio Network. Also, we're being broadcast on the PalTalk stream at paltalk.com. If anybody's interested in actually having the ability to talk back and forth and send messages and share links with other interested parties, definitely go to www.paltalk.com, download the software, get yourself a microphone, and you can join in on that part of that aspect of our program. This is our fledgling broadcast on BBS, and hopefully it will go smoothly. It seems to be pretty smooth so far. We are very honored to have Medea Benjamin as the initial guest on the very first broadcast on BBS, and hopefully at a later point in time we can have you come back and give us an update on all this work that you're doing, because you are one of the people that work tirelessly to bring about change for the better for humanity in general. I mean, we can always look nationalistic in some respects, but humanity is global. And anytime people are killed unjustly, innocent people, the alarm bells are not loud enough. Everyone needs to be aware of it so we can do something about it. One more thing I want to mention. You were talking about John Bolton's approach to the conflict in Lebanon. Dennis Kucinich went over there, and the last leg of his trip, I think he had to go by car, but he took a route Lebanon, Syria, and ended up somewhere in Israel, I do believe. But his comment on the whole thing, what he saw in southern Lebanon, he called it diabolical, because not only was there a mass loss of life, but also hospitals, schools, roads, bridges, power stations, and even agricultural fields of Lebanese lemons were targeted in this aggression. And he called it diabolical. I think he went over there and looked for himself.
Well, just to clarify that point, John, the time when he considered it diabolical is when he went into the West Bank via the Jordan Bridge.
Right.
And upon looking up at the issues that are facing not only the Lebanese but the Palestinian people, that is when he made the connection and considered this a diabolical
plan.
That's
a very strong word, exactly.
That is a strong word.
Well, I was in Lebanon, and when you see the cluster bombs that were used by the Israeli military, and so many thousands of them still in place, not having exploded, you can really understand where that word diabolical comes from, because after the ceasefire is in place, long after the fighting is supposed to have stopped, there will be many innocent civilians, probably mostly children, walking along fields who will step on those cluster bombs and be killed. To use those kind of weapons in the final hours of the conflict, right before the ceasefire went into effect, is certainly diabolical, and I would call it a war crime.
You know, Medea, let me ask you something briefly. Bringing up the issue of the cluster bombs, which is, I believe, especially since they dropped the majority of those cluster bombs in the last 3 days prior to the ceasefire, that was an unbelievable message in and of itself. But I know a lot of groups, Amnesty International, the late Princess Diana, had great issue with these kinds of bombs. And I know that in Lebanon, the reality is that though Israel was forced out by Hezbollah previously, they had never given up under any sort of negotiation the maps that would lead them to disarming the landmines that they had left behind that had covered acres and acres and miles of land. And to this day, they have not relinquished the maps to those landmines so that they could disable them. Now, is Code Pink and all the other organizations that you're working, are you working on any kind of humanitarian issue in relationship to this type of atrocity? And it is a war crime. To do that, and I don't know if you've ever seen what those cluster bombs look like, Medea.
Oh, yeah, and
like
up close. In lots of countries, including Afghanistan.
How are you working in relationship to, like, say, Amnesty International and those groups to help consider this a true war crime?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because just today we've been talking about a campaign against the U.S. companies that continue to make these kind of weapons. And there are two companies here in the U.S., one called Alliant Technologies, which is based in Minneapolis, and another called Textron. And these two companies continue to make cluster bombs despite the campaign against landmines, despite the outcry internationally against weapons that mainly hurt civilians. And we also are going to be not only protesting those companies, but be working with lawyers about what can we do when our government uses our tax dollars to supply Israel with weapons that are condemned internationally. So on several different fronts, we're going to pursue this. We're also trying to organize another group to go to Lebanon to look at two things. One is the oil spill that devastated the coast of Lebanon when the Israelis hit an oil pipeline, and the other is this issue of the cluster bombs, so that people can see firsthand and come home and go to Washington and speak out and try to stop the use of U.S. dollars to go to such crimes.
John, do you have anything to add to that?
That's a hard sell for sure, because we need to look at a graph of the profiteering that has been going on since 2001, and the tentacles reach out pretty far, and they connect a lot of these companies that not only those that Medea points out that she can give us an actual location of the corporation that does the production, but there are a lot of feeder companies that also would contribute to the production of what any international treaty would say would be a weapon that's only purpose is to maim and kill and cause great suffering in a mass scale, a weapon of mass destruction. A cluster bomb is a weapon of mass destruction. If one falls in a group of people, it's going to kill several or maim them, injure them terribly.
Well, and mostly civilians.
Mostly civilians, exactly. And that is, and to have everyone that it would be involved in the production of such weaponry and those involved in the procurement and the appropriation of the funds and the actual business dealings to get these weapons from the manufacturer to the field, it does need to be exposed, because it has no purpose other than suffering, causing civilians to suffer. And it doesn't take the death of any one particular civilian to cause, you know, the suffering is not localized. It spreads out. These are families, and they'd never forget. And when you lose, especially losing pretty much your entire family, you can imagine what that would do as far as the overall attitude about aggression. And it's difficult to get people to sit down at the table and to talk counterproductively financially, to talk back, to get rid of some of the appropriation of some of these tax dollar funds that fund these operations, because there are people that profit from this. And if you look deeply into those that are calling the shots on the global theater, those are the ones that are profiting from the war. It's always been the case.
That's right, John. I think there's several industries. There's obviously the oil industry that has been reaping record profits since the invasion of Iraq to the tune of $350 million a day. There are the companies that sell the military hardware and so like to see wars continue. And then there are those companies that have gotten the contracts, multi-million dollar contracts for U.S. work in Iraq, supposedly for reconstruction, but the Iraqis haven't seen much of it.
And don't forget the civilian contractors, the security contractors that are violating international law with the way they're treating these human beings.
Well, that's right.
Going in with tactics that have been pre-planned. This is part of their, I'm sure they've had seminars on how to conduct interrogation in order to get the maximum effect when you're interrogating a Muslim Arab or an Arab. You can do to an Arab or a Muslim person to humiliate them. And when Lindy England was interviewed after her incarceration, actually she was interviewed, she pointed that out, that a large group of the people in that prison really did not know until they were told to do it the way to interrogate, because they weren't trained interrogators. And then you had private civilian contractors come in that already had it all mapped out. This is the way you do it. And they would give them a thumbs up when they would do these humiliating sessions with photographs that fortunately were leaked out to actually expose that crime. And of course.
But you know, John and Medea, let me bring this point up. Here we have a president, George W. Bush, that sanctioned these Guantanamo Bay type prisons that are actively in pursuing torture techniques that are illegal, not only by the definition of the Geneva Conventions, the International Criminal Courts. We here in our country, in the United States, Medea, have now deemed them illegal, but Guantanamo Bay still exists. What are we doing about that? What are the peace activist movements doing about places like Guantanamo Bay? And just because we pronounced it illegal and it still exists, what is the point?
Well, unfortunately, the Bush administration has not listened to even the Supreme Court, which didn't pronounce Guantanamo Bay illegal, but said that there had to be some kind of due process for people who were being held And that has been totally violated with prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. We in the peace movement have been working with organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights that has been challenging this, calling for the prisoners to have access to lawyers, to have access to something like trials, to be charged with something. We were recently in Washington during the fast we organized against the war when a lot of the hearings around Guantanamo Bay were being held, and we attended those hearings with our signs to close Guantanamo Bay. We spoke out against the continued holding of prisoners without any kind of due process, and we continue to do that. I think there actually is an opportunity for a strange alliance between some of the members of the judiciary inside the military who have recognized that this cannot continue, especially post-Supreme Court decision, and are trying to set up some structures where prisoners would be charged and tried. But it is amazing to see how the Bush administration is holding out to try to continue with keeping people indefinitely in limbo against not only now the Supreme Court, but against all Geneva conventions.
Fascinating. You know, we have to take a break for a moment. We have some public service announcements for our viewing audience. I'm getting ahead of myself. We're talking about video introduction in the near future.
Looking into the future again. So we're very excited, Maria. We are very excited to have this opportunity and this capability to actually broadcast from a grassroots level. We are totally volunteer. We feel that to get the information out, you don't need to profit from it. As long as you speak truthfully and have some sort of compassion, people will listen. You are listening to the BBS Radio Network. Also, you're listening to this program being streamed on paltalk.com. This is the program that we call The People Speak. And how do you put it, Fatima, when the people speak?
When the people speak, everybody listens. It's the way it works. We make a difference.
That's what happens.
The people have to speak. Medea is speaking. We need to speak and make a difference.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about your book, Medea, and you can cover that a little bit. Tell us what's coming up in that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about it.
This week we are going to belay the audience participation in their questions. Hopefully we can get that resolved as we work on the technique that we've got going on here. We will give you the phone numbers for next week before the show is over with. So let's go ahead, send it on over to our director, Don, and we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a bit. So stick with us.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. If you've just joined us, we have been talking to our honored guest, Medea Benjamin, of Code Pink, and as well as other organizations such as Global Exchange. Medea, you have a new book out, Stop the Next War Now. What a fantastic title. Now, can you tell us how you're going to do this?
Well, when we got the idea for the book was right after the invasion of Iraq, when we felt, geez, we'd organized, we had mobilized, we got millions of people out into the street, we did everything we could think of to try to influence our government from taking this disastrous step, and we were unable to do it, and instead of just going into a funk and feeling why bother trying, we decided, all right, we're going to try to stop the soldiers from staying in Iraq, but we have to do more than that, and that's trying to stop the next war. So we put this book together as a way to put out ideas and visions about how do you stop the next war, and it really is a combination of a lot of things. How do we influence the media so they tell us the truth? How do we get people in office who are going to reflect our values? How are we going to create a global community that can work together to influence other institutions like the United Nations? How are we going to teach peace in our schools so that young people grow up with different values? So we've divided the book into many different sections, and these are some of the issues we discuss.
Well, exactly, and this is the how-to situation that I had asked you about earlier. It's like, how do we do this, and what are the tools that we provide people with? And obviously, you've written a manual, a book that will help give the American people the wherewithal and the tools to do this. You know, Medea, some of the things that have been the topic of concern is when you talk about, you know, bringing the troops back from Iraq, you know, a lot of people will say immediate withdrawal. What exactly, do you have a time frame that, and do you, have you studied the dynamics of what an immediate withdrawal financially would, how that would impact the United States of America? Have you guys discussed any of these issues? I'm just curious as to what your thoughts are on some of these things.
Well, when we were in a meeting with the Iraqi parliamentarians, obviously this was the issue foremost on the agenda, and they had different opinions. Some of them said the U.S. troops should be out immediately. Some said that it was past due, that they should have been out already, and others said, well, they have to work to improve the security situation before they get out, and maybe that will take a year or two at the most. So people had different ideas, but I think there was one thing in common, and that was they needed a fixed timetable. Contrary to what George Bush says, he says a fixed timetable would embolden the insurgents. The Iraqis that we met with, who were of very different persuasions, not only ethnically, but also secular and religious, they said that we need to sit down at the negotiating table, not with the al-Qaeda types who are not even Iraqis, who are just here to cause divisions and mayhem, but to sit down with all of the Iraqis who are parties to this conflict. And one of the most important elements when we sit down at the negotiating table is, when are the foreign troops going to leave, and how can we build a reconciliation process around the departure of the U.S. troops? So we feel that it's not so important if we pick a deadline of out by next month or by the end of the year or even the end of 2007. The important thing is to start the process by which the Iraqis will know the deadline that the U.S. is leaving, and we'll be able then to sit down with other armed groups to say, okay, now when are you going to put down your weapons? Now when are we going to put into place a process that would include amnesty for the different parties to the fighting, compensation for the victims, changing some of the laws that the U.S. put in place that actually exacerbate the differences, like the one that's in the Constitution that gives too much authority to the regional sectarian groups and not enough to the national government. So all of these issues have to be discussed as part of a package that includes U.S. withdrawal.
Let me ask you something, Medea, and we're going to be taking some questions from our audience, but we're going to have to do it via us just because of our phone connection today. Let me ask you, considering the United States government has placed in right now, currently in Iraq, over 22 permanent military bases, do you really believe that they have an intention of leaving there?
Well, I don't think they want to leave, and the Iraqi people don't think they want to leave. Iraqis were asked in a poll if they would support their government calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. 87% of them said yes, and then they were asked, do you think that if the Iraqi parliament called for the withdrawal of troops, the U.S. government would listen? And most of the Iraqis said no. They didn't think the U.S. would pay attention because they had intentions of staying there for the long term. So I don't know that there are actually 22 permanent bases, because what does that mean, a permanent base? It really, what we call permanent bases with enough pressure could be turned over to the Iraqis. And I think that we can't just assume that our government has no intention of leaving and that 20 years from now we'll still be talking about how do we get our bases out of there, we have to start from the premise that we can influence our own government, whether it's under the Bush administration or under the next administration. And we have to put Congress on the line, which they have been saying that they don't want permanent bases in Iraq. And you talk about a democratic process. I wonder how many Americans know that both the House and the Senate, controlled by Republicans, have come out twice now against permanent bases in Iraq. But when that legislation with those amendments go into the conference, that means when the House and the Senate come together, the call for an end to permanent bases is eliminated. So it's a terrible example to the Iraqi people and people anywhere in this world when even our pressure to get elected officials to do the right thing works, then it is eliminated by the Bush administration.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the reasons, and we have a couple of questions from our audience, Jen, and I would like to kind of pose to you. But one of the reasons that I mentioned that and questioned the legitimacy of our government actually wanting or desirous of leaving the Iraqi, it was during a congressional hearing when some of the Congress people were forced into actually giving a timetable. And this was pre-Iraq war. This was when they were still trying to convince everyone that we had to go in and attack this evil, barbaric Iraq. And one of the closest conservative estimates that they came up with was a 20 to 50 year occupation of Iraq. Huh. And they believed that was a conservative guess.
Oh, how awful.
I know. And so when I always go back to that, hearing that congressional committee speaking, and that number just blew me away.
It goes so well with the whole proposed long-term global war on terror.
Exactly.
Global
John.
War on terror.
Well, it's to perpetuate a global war. And it amazes me that people don't understand that starting with Osama bin Laden and going through all kinds of people who want to attack Americans, one of the main reasons is we have troops based on their soil, whether it was Saudi Arabia, troops were in Mecca and Medina, the Holy Lands, or whether it's now the troops in Iraq. People don't want us in their country. And if we want to lessen the reasons for people wanting to attack us, we should certainly take our troops out of their lands.
Well, let's look at it this way and see how insane it really is. They attack us because they hate our freedom. We go over to a country that really had nothing to do with those that attacked us, and we take away their freedom. We tell people that you must have goals, and goals have a time frame. But we have no time frame on this war on terror, so we have no real goals. Now, this country needs to be sovereign, but this country is occupied. No nation can be sovereign if they're under occupation. And I think that they use the semantics and the politically correct spin to just make reality whatever they want us to think it is.
Well, and add to your list, they have to have democracy, but then when they elect people, whether it's Hamas or Ahmadinejad in Iran or the Shias in Iraq who hate the United States, we don't want to accept the results of those elections.
Exactly. Again, this is so much. I mean, you said it, John, beautifully. I think we should coin that parody right now and put it on a public service announcement, because people need to hear it and hear how ludicrous it really, really does sound. You know, we have a question here that one of our audience members is asking, and it goes back to the John Bolton issue and what your thoughts on John Bolton. And she's curious about if you know anything about the connection of John Bolton and the School of the Americas, which is basically a terrorist training camp, one here right in our country that Osama bin Laden actually trained at.
And before you answer that, let me add one more thing that the same person posted in the text room. I want to read this to you. It's very brief, but it's very telling. John R. Bolton, the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security Affairs, represents the right wing of the foreign policy establishment. How right? Well, in January 2001, Jesse Helms endorsed Bolton by saying, quote, "John Bolton is the kind of man whom I would want to stand at Armageddon," end quote. Just something to, for people to think about. And you can go ahead and address the connection to the School of Americas and give your opinion on this whole John Bolton. I don't really want to go there. It's very nauseating to me. Go ahead.
John gets very disturbed by this topic. Go ahead, Medea.
Well, I think that I don't know how many of your listeners know about School of the Americas, but here we are talking about terrorism and a war on terror, and the United States has been implicated way before George Bush in training people in the use of torture. I lived in Central America. I've written extensively on one of the countries, Honduras, where thanks to School of the Americas, people were trained in assassinations, and a country that had been relatively calm turned into a country where there were death squads that were killing people because they were speaking out. So the United States has a long history, unfortunately, of teaching terrorist tactics, and especially in the case of Latin America, of training people to torture and to kill. So,
and basically to terrorize.
Well, that's right. Way before we talked about terrorism and the threat of terrorism in this country, we were training people in terrorist tactics.
But then it was 1987 or 1988 when they had the, I think it was the Halabja massacre with the chemical weapons that Saddam Hussein was accused of actually attacking his own people. And evidence points in different directions, but I'm kind of coming to the conclusion that he probably gave the order to have that happen. They were having a war with Iran. It could have, more than likely, he did that. But if you remember, what was the United States' reaction to such a terrible crime against humanity when President Reagan was in office? When they heard that Saddam Hussein had killed maybe even 100,000 of his own people with chemical weapons? Well, the reaction back in those days was, how does it serve our interest? He is a stabilizing force in the region. He is not a threat to us, and we can use him as a tool, as we always do, to get what we want. And there was no vilification with the very right-wing pundits in America. There was not a real groundswell of outcry against this terrible crime that he committed back then. And then what does it take? In March of 2001, Colin Powell said that pretty much Saddam Hussein had no capability to affect anyone. He has no capability to project his force in any direction. But then, when he was needed as an enemy for the war on terror, he suddenly became the most dangerous man in the universe. After all of the things that he had done from the mid-80s up until the early 90s, suddenly all of the reasons seemed to come forward that we need to go in there and take him out. Because he has, well, you know, the main reason was the weapons of mass destruction, which turned out, as far as I'm concerned, to be a flat lie. These people lied to us because that was the best lie that they could come up with to rally us around some sort of connection between the attack on the United States and the country of Iraq. So now
we're in Iraq,
promising them sovereignty, democracy, and freedom while building all these bases, while building this huge embassy, this huge building. I think it's the largest in the world. And the footprints are definitely over there saying they are definitely sending the message that they're not going anywhere for a long time. So when you talk about someone like Jack Murtha, who stands up and says we need to redeploy, it may take 6 months, but we need to consider it because we're not winning. People are dying and we're not winning. We need to redeploy. What happened with that statement? Well, they said, well, let's do a resolution. Who wants to withdraw immediately, as in right now? Of course, nobody's going to vote for that. It would be a good, you know, a good thought to immediately get out of there right now. But I think more people would die if we were just to immediately in a hurry cut and run. But 6 months is a good amount of time to plan it and do it. So they turned it into an immediate withdrawal, and they keep doing that. It's over. The way they play the games with us, it's amazing to me that those who watch reality TV only and then watch the cable news whenever they want titillation are so in the dark about all of this. when the television tells them that Lebanon is being destroyed, the southern part of Lebanon is being just totally emaciated, people are being atomized, infrastructure is being pummeled, the way it's presented is that the terrible terrorist group Hezbollah is doing it all. They're the 100%, they're the sole reason why the innocent people are dying. And the sole reason that innocent people are dying is because munitions are going off in their vicinity and they're killing them. And where are these munitions coming from? Where are these weapons coming from? And your willingness to stand up against those who produce these weapons is very noble. I'm glad that you have the means and the method and the opportunity to do this. I'm very proud of this, of the work that you do.
You know, I'd like to ask Medea, because we're kind of running low on time here, Medea, but there is one question that I wanted to ask. And just for everybody's information, we are speaking with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, she's an unbelievably great American that has written a book, Stop the Next War Now. I highly recommend this book for people that are interested in how they can affect changes in our country today. Let me ask you something on a personal note, Medea. You know, some people call President Bush a great president, and some people call him an idiot. What do you call him?
I wouldn't go with either, but certainly not the former. And I think we tend to do a disservice when we focus on his lack of smarts. I think it's more a danger. He's been a danger to our own security here at home, certainly a terrible danger to people in the Middle East, a danger to the United Nations and the whole idea that we should, as we become more civilized people, find ways to end war. He's taken us in the absolute opposite direction. And when it comes to women, I see the rights of women going back decades, and in the case of Iraq, probably about 50 years, by inadvertently perhaps empowering the very people who are opposed to women's rights. So I think George Bush has been terrible for the global community, terrible for our reputation in the world. When I was in the Lebanon just now, our first meeting was with the United Nations, and their security people actually advised us to say that we were Canadian instead of admitting that we were Americans. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to go around the world pretending I'm something I'm not, because I have a president in place who has so maligned my country's goodwill and reputation that it's dangerous just even to call yourself an American these days.
Well, thank you, Medea, for being with us today. John, let's wrap this show up.
Oh, yes, and thank you very much, Medea. I'm glad we were able to track you down before when we tried to get you on here. You were very, very busy, as we know. We did make it to the meeting that you were in, kind of, and that was very unique. We were able to talk to Ann Wright. And who was the other person, Raed?
Raed Gerard, an Iraqi who's been working with us at Global Exchange. Thanks for having me on, and our websites are globalexchange.org and codepinkalert.org.
That's globalexchange.org, codepinkalert.org. I want to also let everyone know for next week's program, we're going to try to get the call-in feature activated at that point. Note these numbers down, if you would. I'll go through them twice each. In the United States, toll-free, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. In Canada, you can call 888-810-8322. That's 888-810-8322. And if you are outside of North America, dial 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. You've been listening to The People Speak on PalTalk.com's live webcast and also on the BBS radio network. It's been a pleasure. This is our fledgling program. I think everything went pretty well. We want to send our thanks out to Medea Benjamin, and thank you, Basima, and Don in the shadows.
And thank you, John, and thank you, Don.
It's time to say goodnight. We'll do the closing music, and next week our guest will be, we hope, Ed Asner is going to try his best to come in here, and hopefully we can pin him down because I have a lot of questions to ask Mr. Asner. So that's next week, next Tuesday at 8 p.m.
Thank you, Medea, and good night, everyone.
And good night, everybody.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of the past, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is mine, land from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.